Texas A&M.
I am from Texas A&M. I'm a born and bred Texan, so that's a bragging point for Marlon. Okay. All right. So I want to begin just by thanking the organizers. Thank you to Yakir, to Jeff, to Lucian, to all the Perimeter staff for inviting me here. It's a great honor to be here with such illustrious colleagues. I wanted to talk to you about today, because when Jeff invited me, he said, come to speak about quantum foundations and paradoxes and concepts. And I said, okay, this is going to be all about Yakir. And so I wanted to talk about something that was closely related to Yakir's work. But then I realized I had something that's kind of been on the back burner for about maybe 10 years or something that I always wanted to finish, but I never quite got around to it. So I said, okay, Jeff, I'm going to talk to you about the error of time in quantum measurements because that will give me a future boundary condition to be able to have the results done to be able to share with you today. Okay. So this picture, I was here a week ago. We were hanging out doing lots of great work with Jeff and friends here. And that's a picture there. I think we went over to St. Jacob's for dinner one night, so with Yakir and other friends. Okay, good. So the work I'm going to be telling you about today is in collaboration with these people. I'm going to get the trusty hockey stick out, Lucian. Yeah. So my longtime friend and collaborator, Alexander Korotkov, we started thinking about this a long time ago. My current PhD student, Aria Chantastri. My former PhD student, Justin Dressel, who's now gone to fame and fortune at Chapman University, which perhaps we should rename as Aharonov University. And then also my experimental collaborator, Kater Murch. Maybe I should mention on the previous slide, all these people fund very sort of practical and sort of mainstream science things. The stuff I'm talking to you about is more foundational, and so I have to acknowledge the John Templeton Foundation for funding Kater and I to work on this more foundational kinds of questions. Okay, and he's at Washington University in St. Louis. And so we're designing together some experiments, so hopefully this will not just be a theoretical idea, but we'll have some experimental data in the near-term future to show with you. Okay, so here is the outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about, it's the era of time, so I'm going to talk about time symmetry. So I'm going to review for you how time symmetry works first in classical physics, then in statistical physics, and then I'm going to show you how things go horribly wrong when I go into quantum mechanics, and this measurement stuff destroys our beautiful time symmetry, and how people have been fighting and clawing to get it back all these many years. I'll review sort of Yakir's famous move to restore time symmetry, and then I'm going to introduce some new results here at this talk. We're talking about our style, our way of doing it, which I like to call the Janus measurement sequences, named after Janus, the Roman god of time, of beginnings and endings and doorways. And then I'm going to talk about, once I restore the time symmetry, if I still even have an arrow of time or not. All right, so let's begin by the physics of time symmetry in classical physics. So we all know that if I have this equation Yakir wrote for us this morning in terms of a Hamiltonian, if I have conservative dynamics, and I simply take the time inverse transformation, I exchange t goes to minus t, then that has the effect of reversing the momenta. The momentum goes to the minus momenta. And lo and behold, if I make those transformations of these equations, if I run my movie backwards, if I rewind the movie, so to speak, I have what looks like a legitimate forward time evolution with exactly the same equations of motion. So this is what we call time symmetry in classical physics. And this we can think about you can't distinguish past from future under this kind of dynamics. But this is all sort of theoretical, and my friend John Howe likes to say, I'm an inwardly, somewhere deep down, there's an experimentalist trying to get out of my soul. And so I decided to get my hands dirty, and I went into the laboratory. And my laboratory is actually down one floor and over that way into the pool hall of the Perimeter Institute. I did some experiments, and so these are movies I took with my own two hands here, with some help. I'll get to that in a minute. And we're going to play a game. I'm going to show a movie for you, and you have to guess if the movie is going forward or backward. Okay, there's one movie.
Definitely backwards.
And there's I love it. Thank you, Ephraim. All right, so which was which? Which was this forward or backward?
Right.
All right. So the true answer is that, yes, this was backward and this was forward. And the only way you could tell, other than Ephraim's universal law of motion, was the fact that maybe if you had a very close attention to detail, you saw the ball slightly slowing down toward in the forward movie and slightly speeding up in the backward movie. And that's that pesky friction that keeps destroying our quantum arrow of time in classical physics. So we'll get back to friction in a minute. But let's keep playing this game. What happens if I had a couple balls? Something like this. Okay, now let's play that backwards and see what we get. Okay, so you can tell pretty clearly which way is going forward and which way is going backward in that movie. Let's play it again. So this is my favorite one here. Let's see. Is this the same one? I think this is the same one. We'll see. Yeah, that's the same one. Okay, just a minute. Okay, so here's a three-ball example. And I like this one. This is my favorite. Okay, so that's one way. Is that forward or past? What's that? Yeah, okay, let's try this way. Okay, it's a little bit more tricky. Why is it tricky? Well, I'm getting two of these guys going. This, by the way, took a long time. I took several minutes, you know, to make this movie. I had graduate student assistants to help me get this right. And so, but still, we can still slightly begin to tell the difference between past and future when we have more degrees of freedom in the problem. But now let's sort of take it to an extreme level. Let's take it to the break. And now we're not so much going from past to future necessarily, but from ordered to disordered. So here is the forward break. Okay. And here is the reverse break. Okay, so it's cute, right? So even though each of those collisions, following the argument I gave you on slide 2 or 3, is time reversal invariant, we can still tell the difference, the error of time, by the statistical argument, by the fact that we go from a high entropy situation to a low entropy situation. And so even though the microscopic laws are time reversal invariant, there's still an error of time, a statistic we call a statistical error of time. So I'm going to pursue that idea. So let's go from classical physics to statistical physics to quantum mechanics. Okay? How do we do time reversal in quantum mechanics? Well, here is the Schrodinger equation and the position representation. What I do to switch, I do the same thing I did before. I switch t to minus t. That flips the sign here. How can I get an equation that's exactly like a forward equation? What I have to do is I have to complex conjugate the wave function in the position basis. And in general, I need to also conjugate the Hamiltonian. Why is that? And sometimes people forget about that. Well, if I have something like a magnetic field in the problem, then I have this rule P goes to P plus EA. This is really the minus I times a gradient. And so to get the time reversal invariance right, I've also got to flip the sign of magnetic field as well. Okay, so that's time reversal invariance in the Schrodinger equation. And that's fine and good. So we have exactly the same kind of parallel we can draw with classical physics. But now what happens about when I add in more realistic things, like decoherence, right? So what is decoherence? This is sort of what I like to call quantum friction. So just like we could tell the difference of the error of time in the presence of the pool balls with friction, we have processes where we exchange energy with an environment that's open, for example, or we entangle some other degrees of freedom. And so this tends to have a direction of time in the system. But in principle, I can think about time reversing everything, the microscopic degrees of freedom, and so still being able to recover back the reverse dynamics. But now measurement is a different kind of animal. What about measurement as opposed to simply decoherence? And I want to take a moment here to quote John Wheeler. Wheeler says, we're dealing with a quantum event that makes itself known by an irreversible act of amplification, by an indelible record and act of registration. So what's happening here, you can't reverse it, Wheeler tells us. Or can you? So let's talk a little bit about that. So the idea is that we think about quantum mechanics, we prepare some initial quantum state. We have some unitary dynamics like this. I can go forward in time. I can go backward in time. But then when I measure, I have this collapse of the wave function. I have a perfectly nicely entangled or coherent state. I project into some eigenstate of the measurement operator, and I cannot unproject. The red arrow blocks me from going backwards here. So this breaks the time symmetry of the physics. I have some asymmetry. And the way I can think about it is that if in the process of measurement I learn something about the quantum system, can I then go back and unlearn it? Okay. All right, so we like time symmetry in physics, so is there any way to rescue this situation? So usually this is the forward propagation, and so we have Yakir coming to the rescue now to help us, to teach us how to rescue the situation. And his idea, dating back to 1964, a decade before I was born, is the following. I start with some strong measurement, a projective measurement at time in the beginning, in the past, and then eventually I have some final measurement that I post-select on. So I take only the events that give me this final state, and then Yakir showed famously that that's a time reversal invariant object. I can flip the arrow of time, and that stays exactly the same. He realized in 1988 he can stick in a very, very weak measurement here, and that doesn't change the story at all. Okay, so this has been known for a while now. It's been a very fruitful idea. Lots of people are going to be talking about that. But I want to tell you something new and different, and so I'm going to talk about our way of trying to generalize this idea to expand it to something else, a new paradigm for time reversal symmetry. So here is our new paradigm. Yes, so I guess the point is here, again, we've restored the symmetry between past and future in this kind of picture. So here's our proposal. So our proposal is to use this phenomena we started developing and thinking about back in 2006, which is the idea of the possibility of uncollapsing the wave function or undoing quantum measurements. And this has now been observed in, I think, at least two experiments, one a superconducting qubit experiment, and one is an optical experiment with single photons. And the idea is the following. So here is this quantum measurement reversal idea. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce some generalized measurement on some time step I get to choose and ask what it takes to reverse that measurement. So a generalized measurement is no longer a projection operator. Projection operator is a many-to-one operation, which cannot be reversed. But if I have a generalized measurement, now that it's a one-to-one operator, I can describe that with some measurement operator, sometimes called a Krauss operator, MA. And the idea is I make some generalized measurement here at time A with some particular result. And so suppose, for example, I don't know what the initial state is. I have no knowledge of that. I disturb it to some other unknown state, partial collapse. And then the idea is I make a subsequent, another measurement, we'll call it just B. And if I get the right result, little b, then it turns out that that transformation undoes that disturbance that I talked about. And if I get this, then I've successfully uncollapsed the wave function, even if I didn't know anything about it. All right. On the other hand, I could get some other result, we'll call it B prime, which I can know, which gives me some other third unknown state, and then I would fail to reverse it. So this is a stochastic measurement reversal. So this is the first transformation. The second transformation is I want MB times MA to be proportional to the identity. So that's the basic idea of measurement reversal, and we're going to try to use that idea together to think about the error of time. So here is the proposal. Consider some temporal sequence of measurements, one after the other, with results R0, R1, R2, and so on to Rn. That creates a series of transformations from an initial vector, phi, and eventually to go to some other vector, psi, which I can time reverse if I want. The idea is to introduce another series of measurements, where I have this upside down series of measurements. So that if I start from the final state and I occupy and I act with these upside down measurements and backwards, I get back to the initial state, psi. Okay? So the idea is I want to choose the upside down measurements so that for every possibly different forward measurement with some result, Rj, we're going to apply some different backward measurements with some outcome, which I call upside down Rj, to the inverse measurement operator. Okay, and we're going to end up reversing the sequence in which we apply these measurements. Okay, so here's what I call the forward Janus sequence. So the idea is each of these measurements corresponds to some measurement operator MR1, MR2, all the way to MRN, such that when I act upon this initial ket, I get this final ket. And then I've introduced the so-called backward Janus sequence so that now if I apply the upside down measurements acting on state phi, I eventually recover state psi. Okay, where I define what these are. So the conclusion we want to draw here is if I demand this sequence, the Janus measurement sequence, the reverse one, must involve a series of measurements which has some possible outcome, such that the measurement satisfies this condition. So the upside down measurement result is proportional to the inverse of the time reversed measurement results. Okay?
And this naturally accounts for the unitary case we talked about previously. So this is our condition. And when I say possible, I'm going to stress that qualifier. So we'll come back to that, why that's important, in a minute. Okay. So I want to give a simple example of how this works in practice that you could do in a laboratory. So rather than doing a bunch of generalized measurements one after the other, let's do a simple example of just a continuously measured qubit so that the sequence, the iteration, goes to zero, and I continuously measure in time. Okay? So it's relatively easy to realize if I think about just measuring a two-level system, because the forward measurements can be very simply related to the backward measurements in this instance. So the idea is that this sequence of discrete measurement results becomes continuous function, R of t, and so that the measurement operator for some small time can be expanded as something like an identity plus this time step plus, in general, this measurement operator. That's one specific case, times an operator A that characterizes the system bath interaction. And what you see is that if I apply a time transformation operator, well, there are a couple of possibilities depending on how this operator transforms. But if it transforms in the simplest way of being the same, what you see is that I can invert that operator very simply by thinking about the negative result. So if the result is positive going forward, I want the result to be negative going backward, but time reverse. So if this is upside down as a time R, I need to negate the result, but within the reverse time sequence. So this is the idea. So how does this work? So let's take a simple example. So if I have a continuous measurement of a two-level system, I have these stochastic equations of motion that describe this result. I've written this in the so-called Sultanovich form. So x, y, z are the coordinates on the block sphere. There's a characteristic measurement time scale tau to be able to resolve the state that I'm measuring, tau. And then I drive the system with some kind of unitary drive, for example, h bar omega times sigma y. So the idea, if I just look at these as the equations of motion, I see that just like before with the classical equations of motion, I can time reverse them in this way if I simply keep x, y, z the same in the simple case and then reverse the measurement outcome. R goes to minus r. So this would invert the unitary, and then also omega goes to minus omega. So this would invert the unitary part. This would invert the non-unitary part. Okay. So this is the idea, and so we're to consider a particular case, the so-called diffusive Rabi limit, where this measurement, this rate of driving omega, is fast compared to the rate of measurement. So I basically spin around the block sphere with some phase diffusion. So now you see that I've actually restored the time symmetry to this problem by thinking about a forward propagation that corresponded to a result positive R of t, and then a backwards course evolution that corresponded to minus R of t minus big T minus little t. Okay, so I've restored the time symmetry in this new way. But now we can begin to ask the question, can I still be able to discern an error of time for this physics? So here is the basic idea. I have some movie, just like I showed you the pool movies of the quantum state, moving, say, from past to future, let's say, starting in the green arrow as the initial state, tracing this path. This is, by the way, this is called the quantum trajectory, the state of motion in the quantum state space as time moves on. And then talking also about realizing the reverse trajectory, where I go forward like this. Now, you see that I've not only written this quantum trajectory, but we've talked about movies. We've moved beyond the era of silent movies, so we like to have a soundtrack or an audio that goes with our movie. And so the audio that goes with the movie is the continuous measurement result. So in the forward direction, we would have this as our audio soundtrack going forward, but in the reverse direction, we have to reverse the order and then also flip the sign to go backward. Okay, so this is essentially then showing that I cannot tell from the state itself the difference between past and future, but as I'll argue now, by looking at the relative probability of this likelihood versus that likelihood, I will be able to distinguish past from future. Okay, so is there still an error of time? And the simplest case, because I'm talking to an audience of Yakir people, that I'm not thinking about post-election now, the answer is yes, and because, so there's a statistical one, since the probability of going forward versus backward is different. So just like in the beginning of my talk, let me play a game. And the game is I show you a movie of the quantum trajectory, And you have to guess if I'm playing it forward or backward, and then you can use the probability density of the results, just like I had the pool game earlier. But now there's a stochastic element in it. Okay? And so how do we do this? Well, we can use Bayes' rule to calculate. We can think about this as a hypothesis testing game. I have the possibility of a forward-moving movie or the possibility of a backward movie. You have to guess. So we can use Bayes' rule to say, given the measurement record R of T, what's the probability that it's moving forward, for example? And so this is an exercise in Bayes' rule using the priors PF and PB. And these other distributions is just the likelihood of this moving, getting a result R of T if it's forward, or the likelihood of minus R of T if it's going backwards. So these are likelihood functions. All right, so we can think about the likelihood function in a very simple way. If I take the ratio of this forward distribution to the backward distribution, this is basically, if it's something that's bigger than 1, it's more likely that the movie is going forward, and if it's less than 1, it's more likely that it's going backwards. So I can think about taking the log likelihood of the forward and I subtract it from the log likelihood of the backwards. That would give me the logarithm of this ratio. If I then average that over the forward distribution, this is what's called as the relative entropy between the forward and the backward distributions, which we can use to quantify the distinguishability between these two movies. So here are some histograms that have been plotted by Aria and Justin, and the idea is that if I have a relatively short movie, so it turns out this average distinguishability scales like the time of my duration of my experiment divided by the measurement time. It's very simple. So for relatively short movies, it's a toss-up. The probability I make a mistake is about half and half, more or less, and I have this kind of distribution. So if it's to the right of the dashed line, that's more likely forward going, and if it's to the left of the dashed line, it's more likely going backward movie. But if I take it time longer, so for example, here is a half a measurement time, this vertical line is the average here, that moves to the right, and so more of my histogram is to the right of zero, so it's more likely to be moving forward versus backward, and then if I make it go longer and longer, it becomes, first of all, it becomes more Gaussian, and also becomes less and less likely to guess incorrectly. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So just for fun, here are a couple of examples of seemingly backwards in time trajectories that go from past to future if you look at the log likelihood. So here the log likelihood difference is about -3. Here it's about -2. And you see this is the XYZ coordinates. So based on this game, you would conclude that these are actually going backwards in time. All right, so let me just mention briefly a couple of experiments that have been done recently that could be done to do this, realize this experimentally. So I work closely with the Siddiqui group at UC Berkeley that have shown the ability to track quantum trajectories, also Benjamin Uhr in Paris, and of course I already mentioned Cater in Washington that are working on these kinds of experiments. And just to illustrate this, this is a figure from their paper of Nature in 2013, where they show the ability to track in real time these quantum trajectories of a single run of the measurement and be able to faithfully reproduce them using a tomographic technique to be able to verify that they're tracking single trajectories. Okay, so the idea is that you run this kind of experiment and then apply the protocol we prescribe. Okay, so things I want to investigate. So for example, because I'm here with Yakir and friends, what happens if I add post-selection on the final boundary condition? You can ask me more about that in the questions if you're interested. What about the most likely paths? What's their time symmetry? How general is this example? How easy is it to come up with examples that have this measurement reversal phenomenon and you can do the error of time symmetry? And then what does this mean for something like a retrodictive quantum mechanics? All right, so here's my summary. I reviewed for you ideas in time symmetric physics. I introduced some new paradigm for reestablishing time symmetry in quantum mechanics in the presence of any number of sequences of measurements, and then showed how this could work in a fairly straightforward example using a single qubit being continuously measured, and proposed some experiment. So I call these Janus measurements because Janus, this Roman god, is depicted with two faces. With one face, he looks towards the future, and with the other face, he looks towards the past. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions? If you take your measurement, you continue it from until finally all the way, and then you create the Hamiltonian already going further, you can still go backwards there. There's no limit to how long, as long as no decoherence, there is no way.
So let me repeat it, Yukira, to see if I get your comment. So you say I keep applying a measurement until, say, it completely projects, and you say then apply a unitary to go up, say, to the x-axis, and then continue. So then can I reverse it? So I think I can reverse the unitary part, no problem. But then if I have an ideal projection, that's a many to one operation. So I think if it's a perfect projection,
how do you define ideal projection? As long as you keep the system interacting with the measuring device only according to the interaction of Hamiltonian,
yes.
There's no projection.
Yes.
So it can come all the way to what you call it.
I think as long as it happens in a continuous way, you can always decompose it and then come back. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, good.
Since the quantum trajectories of the qubit under time continuous measurement are just diffusive trajectories,
yes,
on the Bloch sphere.
Yes.
Doesn't it mean that the same concept would have been tested on a classical government motion? I mean, there is not much quantum specific about the concept you offer to distinguish between past and future on the basis of Brownian motion process.
Okay, yes. So the question is, what's different from my point of view or from this thing I described to just looking at Brownian motion? So it's a good question.
Yeah.
So if I just have plain Brownian motion, it's just diffusion on a line, let's say. And then the point is I don't need to do anything to look at the backward process from the forward process. So if I look at like a little speck of pollen bouncing around in a gas of molecules, say with smoke in it, and then I show you the reverse movie, it's basically exactly the same statistically. So you have no way of being able to distinguish past from future in that for a single trajectory. And so here it's a little bit different because basically you tend to be attracted towards the collapse points, and so that would be the elements of the quantum mechanics. So I cannot perfectly reverse or I still have the statistical way of distinguishing error of time. But there are a lot of similarities, I think, from just classical diffusive systems.
Over. Yeah, I would like to ask, is there any way to judge how strong this irreversibility is from the measurement operators?
Yes, absolutely. So one thing you can do just for a single measurement, you can say how likely is it that I can reverse it, and so we have some general bounds related to the forward operator that limit the likelihood of reversal, and so that sort of increase, you can increase the asymmetry between past and future with that kind of stronger or intermediate strength measurement, we can call it.
Is there a simple measure you could put on the operator directly mathematically?
Yes. So it's the minimum eigenvalue, I think, of the square of the operator that characterizes a degree of irreversibility.
Andrew, I love that. How does this depend on what you do with the results of the measurement? For example, if you just dump them, or if you store them, or if you feed them back, or even if you use them in some sort of feed-forward system to decide what the next measurement should be.
Yeah, it's a great question, Andrew. Thank you. So in this case, the way I formed it is we just basically are playing this game. So the idea is I can run these measurements, and I store them in a computer and come back in 10 years, and I can still play the game with you. So in that sense, it's not an adaptive kind of measurement, but I mean, those kinds of feed-forward or feedback kinds of protocols, that's something we're very interested in and we're playing games with. So I mentioned this Templeton grant we have with Cater. So one of the bullet points on our to-do list is to look at those kind of games where you have, and Jeff knows about this, where you imagine you have some kind of algorithm where I can try to do this feed-forward thing, And then usually what you do is you can ask about time symmetry with this kind of algorithm. Because usually what you do with feedback, what we do like with Irfan's group, is you measure something, you see what the result is, you change something about the system, and then so there's sort of this dance between what you learn and what you're doing. But then you can sort of turn that on its head, right? You can turn it upside down, and you can say, what if I tried to run that backwards in time, right? How would I do that? Would I have to do some kind of anticipatory feed forward? So the future results, I would somehow need to guess in advance to be able to apply result. So you could do post-selected games like that, but you could imagine even doing crazy things. So I think that's all right. That's what I wanted to say off the top of my head.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
John? In 89, Bukira and Yuva Amadon wrote a paper on the evolution of quantum trajectories. And in the last 5 years, they're now calling it the ratio, the type of ratios you're talking about, is quantum speed limits. And in terms of how a state cut operator evolves in time. And what you've got there is essentially a magnetic operator as a way of thinking about it. Have you thought about whether or not there is going to be a difference doing a neutral versus non-neutral evolution of something forward and back and forth in time?
That's a great question. So I know a little bit about these quantum speed limits. I hadn't thought about them in this case, but one of the differences that comes to mind is, you know, so I'm doing this measurement, and the measurement is something like, you know, e to the r times some operator. And what operator I use there could transform differently under time reversal. So usually, like, if I think about sort of the classic example, so position, how does position change under time reversal? It just goes to position. Momentum, it's got a flip sign. Angular momentum, it's got a flip sign. Spin, it's got a flip sign, right? So depending on which operator you choose, they behave differently. And so it turns out that if you have one that itself flips sign of the simple form I gave, you don't even have to flip the measurement result. You could just reverse the order and not have to flip the sign of the measurement result. But yeah, it's a good question.
Okay, any other questions?
Your initial examples, you have friction.
Yeah.
You told us what is forward and what is backward. Then you are considering kind of quantum measurement, which you had only formal definition of it.
Yes.
But it seems to me that probably you can define them kind of time symmetrically, so everything will be time symmetric. It's not friction. So if it's not friction, well, then I suspect that everything should be time symmetric.
Yeah, so that's my whole point of my talk, Lev. That's exactly right. You got it. Right? But there is quantum friction, right? That's called decoherence. Right, and so this is an addition to what I talk about. So if I have interactions with some unknown degrees of freedom that go off into oblivion or whatever, I can't manually reverse that. Right, so there's no easy way. If I add friction to this, or if I add decoherence, there's no easy reversal of that in the dynamical equations of motion. You can see that very easily if I go back here. Right, if I add something like minus gamma x minus gamma y, right, there's not any particularly easy way to invert that.
Are you sure that there's no way to do it?
No, Lev. I mean, so I mentioned this in my slide. If I microscopically reverse everything, then it's no problem. Right? It's like the pool break playing backwards. Right. Okay.
You care? No, we're done? Okay.
Yes.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Okay.